It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Milwaukee police officer who shot Dontre Hamilton is appealing to get his job back today. We'll take a look back at the details of Hamilton's shooting and its impact on the community.
First, our next guest says cuts to food stamp benefits are making life hard for more than 250,000 low-income Wisconsin households. Seniors and people with medical conditions are especially hard hit.
The cuts are due to changes in the federal Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, known as Food Share here in Wisconsin.
Sherry Tussler joins us now. She's Executive Director of Milwaukee's Hunger Task Force. Sherry, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
So what changed with these cuts?
Well, a number of things changed. The economic stimulus bill known as ARA ended, and so some people lost food stamp benefits more than a year ago. And then some other people lost benefits when the HEAT and EAT cuts happened, and that was something that affected seniors and people with disabilities living in public housing or any rental unit that had its heat included in its rent. Those people no longer get the standard utility allowance, and as a result have lost up to $90 per month in food stamp buying power. And then last but not least, upcoming, we've got work requirements for food share, and those work requirements are going to be pretty severe, and the state anticipates more than 66,000 individuals being cut off here in the state of Wisconsin.
Now, is this mainly due to changes at the federal level or the state level?
Both, really. The federal level was ARA. The federal level was clearly heat and eat because that was part of the farm bill, although our state did nothing to take any action to correct that situation when it could and still can correct that situation. And then more recently with the work requirements, our state volunteered to participate in the food stamp employment and training program, which will require able-bodied adults between 18 and 49 to work at least 80 hours per week in order to receive their food share benefits.
Did you say 80 hours a week?
Excuse me, 80 hours per month.
Per month, okay, gotcha. How many Wisconsinites depend on food stamps or benefits like that?
More than 825,000 people use food stamps in the state of Wisconsin in 2014 on a monthly basis.
Now, can you tell us maybe about a person that you've come across and how that has affected them individually?
Well, for the seniors specifically, they live in public housing. Their incomes are very modest. Their expenses are high due to medical bills. And they are receiving cuts that will take them from $125 on average a month down to $16 a month. Losing $100 a month in food buying power if you're a senior with a fixed income is devastating. People are saying that they will never be able to buy new clothing again. They will never get new shoes again. Some people are saying that they're at risk of losing their subsidized housing because they can't afford to live independently with the modest income that they have.
So what happens when there is a cut like that? Do these people then rely more heavily on food banks?
Food pantries throughout the state of Wisconsin are about to take a pretty heavy hit. We are already seeing seniors lining up at the food pantries here in Milwaukee, but our greater concern is this food stamp employment and training program because the state anticipates literally losing almost 70,000 people from the food stamp program statewide. Here in Milwaukee County, it'll be about 14,500 people. And so if you think about it, just Milwaukee County perspective, we serve about 34,000 individuals at our food pantry network right now. If we put another 14,500 on top of that group, our food bank and our food pantry system could go bankrupt.
In terms of educating people about these cuts and maybe what they could do, if anything, to shore up what they had or to plan, what kind of education efforts were there?
The state hasn't conducted any education efforts. People would be called in for their review, and they would have their benefits cut. They would be called in for their review. They would be told you're going to be working now. And if you don't prove that you're working, we will close your case. So that's one of the challenging things is that when you make these sort of sweeping changes, at least in our opinion, people should be educated about it. And the state has resources to do that and has chosen not to.
Now, to talk further about food share and that participation rate, it seems to have dropped by 4.6% last year. What do you put that down to?
Those are seniors and people with disabilities who no longer are eligible for the food share program because their heat was included in their rent.
Well, last year, lawmakers decided to discontinue the state's participation in the Heat and Eat program. And in Wisconsin, it seems like there may be some motion on this here. What are you seeing, and how does Wisconsin compare when it comes to Heat and Eat?
Well, there were 16 or 17 other states, mostly northern states, that were using sort of the standardized deduction in order to figure a food stamp case. Food stamps are based on income, assets, and expenses, including utilities. And so they simplified the figuring of your utilities by giving you a dollar in low-income energy assistance. The federal farm bill says now it's got to be a minimum of $20. So our state hasn't taken any action to increase that dollar to $20, even though it's a federal pool of money, and we have it, and we could. And as a result, we've lost about $276 million in food share buying power, which is federal money here in the state of Wisconsin.
Now, to go back to an earlier point, what do you see as being the problem with asking younger, able-bodied people to work in order to get food stamps?
Hunger Task Force actually thinks that food or work is the most dignified way to get your food, and we really support people working. The problem is that there aren't jobs available in many places here in Wisconsin, both urban and rural, and mandating work doesn't mean that people find employment. So our concern is around jobs, and our concern is around whether or not those jobs will lift people out of poverty. Lots of people may end up working or are already working on food share. Right now, 39% of the people who are those able-bodied adults are already working, but their wages don't lift them above the poverty level, so they still have to get food share.
And presumably, those people are not the disabled. They are not the elderly. So in terms of impact, how does that break down?
What you have to imagine is all these single adults, ages 18 to 49, scrambling to either work 80 hours a month, volunteer 80 hours a month, or demonstrate that they're exempt from the program, either because they have a mental problem, a physical condition, or a child or other person that's in their care that requires them to stay home.
And what would you like to see happen going forward? Obviously, you're concerned about this. If you had it your way, what would you ask for?
Well, if we were going to create a job program, I would like to see links to employers. And the particular organization that the state chose to contract with here in Milwaukee County is a for-profit organization that doesn't have any links to employers. And so literally they're being paid to sort through people who are supposed to be able-bodied and determine whether or not they are working. They're not going to help them find jobs. And I would think that a job training program should actually train people and help them find employment.
And finally, Sherry, what do you see happening if there isn't some change to the benefits you're talking about?
Well, beginning in August, what's going to happen is people are going to start having their cases closed. Anybody who does not work the 80 hours and prove that they worked, the computer will come along and sweep their case closed after 90 days. You can get 90 days of food share eligibility if you're an able-bodied adult every 3 years. And so their cases will be closed for 3 years. I think what we're going to see is more and more people put in desperate situations where they have to rely on food pantries, soup kitchens, or homeless shelters in order to meet their most basic needs. And I guess I'm just really concerned that that's not the kind of Wisconsin that I thought I grew up in.
Sherry, thank you for joining us.
You bet.
We've been speaking with Sherry Tussler, Executive Director of Milwaukee's Hunger Task Force.
First, the disciplinary appeal of Christopher Manny, the Milwaukee police officer who shot and killed Dontre Hamilton in April of last year, is scheduled to begin in downtown Milwaukee today at 4:30.
Christopher Manny was fired from the Milwaukee Police Department after the shooting because the department says he did not follow protocol when he frisked Hamilton. The questions of racial disparities in Wisconsin's police and criminal justice system that this case brought about were reignited 2 weeks ago with the shooting of black 19-year-old Tony Robinson in Madison.
Corrine Hess is a Milwaukee-based freelance journalist. Her story of the events of Dontre Hamilton's death and the aftermath is featured in this month's issue of Milwaukee Magazine. Corey, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, remind us of the basics of the facts here. What do we know for sure happened on that day in April last year?
Well, what we know for sure is that Dontre Hamilton was sleeping in a park in downtown Milwaukee. A barista at Starbucks, which is located in that park, called the police department. Two officers came and determined twice that Dontre was not causing any trouble, and then Officer Christopher Manny came. He ended up frisking Dontre, and they got into an altercation. Dontre grabbed Officer Manny's baton, and during that, Officer Manny shot Dontre several times and killed him. So that happened, and then that was at the end of April, and in October, Police Chief Flynn fired Officer Manny, and that is the hearing that is beginning today.
And as we mentioned, Officer Manny was not fired for the shooting itself. What did Chief Flynn say was the reason for that firing?
The reason for the firing was the whole how he approached Dontre and had him stand up and then patted him down. So it was going against police protocol with the pat down and the search.
As I understand it, this is the first case of an officer being fired for contributing to a person's death in the line of duty. Why was this particular case, why did it lead in this direction?
Well, in talking to Chief Flynn, he believed that after reviewing this, that that Officer Manny did violate the what the police should have done. And in looking at what the first two officers did by not having Dontre get up, by recognizing that he had some mental health issues and leaving him alone, Chief Flynn thought that the right thing to do was to fire Officer Manny. So that now is what this commission is going to decide.
Now, in your piece, you try to take this beyond the facts of the matter and kind of this national conversation about these police-involved shootings and tell us the story of the individuals involved. Can you tell us a little bit about Dontre Hamilton and his family and how they've done since this event?
Mm-hmm. His family, you know, the one thing that came out right after the shooting was that Dontre was homeless. And that really wasn't the case. He had spent the night before at a hotel. He was living in a transitional housing unit for people with mental health issues, and the TV wasn't working, so he wanted to watch movies. He liked to fall asleep to watch movies, and so he was not actually homeless. He had the support of his family, his mother and his father. They weren't married. They're divorced, but both of them were in his life, as well as his brothers. And so that, just characterizing him as homeless, really is what I think sparked his family to get involved with the media. They told me right away that they hadn't planned on talking to the media. They wanted to just deal with this privately, but they were really upset that that he was talked about as being somebody who was homeless and who was violent, and they say that he was not. So, I mean, I don't know if he had been. I don't believe that he was homeless, though. And his family's been very involved since the shooting.
And talk about Dontre Hamilton's life. He was an ambitious young guy trying to get jobs before I think you could legally get jobs even. And then he had this sad turn to mental illness.
He did. When he was in his early 20s, he started hearing voices, according to his brother and his friends. He was really paranoid. His brothers actually didn't want to believe it. They, you know, they grew up together playing and roughhousing and just like any other brothers would do. And they didn't want to admit that something was wrong with Dontre. And then just the things started getting worse for him. And he did try to commit suicide. And that's when they realized that there was a problem. And he was admitted to the mental health complex and diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. He was on medication, but because of different issues with the system, not being able to get the medication or stay on a schedule, he wasn't on it regularly like he should have been.
I want to talk about Officer Manny's story since this shooting. I know I gather he hasn't talked directly to the press much. What have we heard from him as far as statements or via people he's been in contact with?
Yeah, I was able to talk to the police union, and they've been meeting, President Mike Crivello has been meeting with Officer Manny at least weekly, and it's been a rough road for Officer Manny as well. You know, he has said that he's had post-traumatic stress disorder, and he's filed an application for disability retirement. So even if he doesn't get his job back, he may be able to still receive a portion of his salary. He has a few young children. He's a single father. He's not really been able to go out in public. I mean, he's also dealing with having to know that he killed a man. So this has not been easy for Officer Manny.
And on what grounds is he challenging his discipline, his firing from the force?
What I believe they are going to do today is talk about how, like you said earlier, nowhere in history, or at least in the last 45 years, has there been an officer fired for a fatal on-duty shooting. So I believe that's the grounds that they're going to go for today.
I want to put this in the context of a few different stories we've been watching. First of all, mental illness and the system in Milwaukee and around the country. Is that one of the lessons people are trying to take away? One, a silver lining to solve mental health problems, make treatment more available for people in Dontre Hamilton's situation?
I think it's what they're hoping can be taken away. One thing that Maria Hamilton, Dontre's mother, has really been trying to do is work with the mental health community. She's received a lot of accolades from the mental health community for her work. I think it's been sidetracked a little bit just by everything that's going on with Officer Manny, and then also this latest situation in Madison. She's been in Madison protesting along with her son, Nate, but she has been working with the mental health community to try to raise awareness. So hopefully this is some good that will come out of this.
And as you just alluded to, you write that over time we've switched the focus here from the issues of mental health to issues of race in this shooting. How did that happen? Why do you say that?
Well, I think when this happened here in April, you know, it didn't get a lot of play. It actually really didn't get a lot of notice nationally at all. And then other things across the country started happening. Ferguson, of course, and other shootings. And then, again, the Dontre Hamilton case really didn't get much notice. But it slowly did through its grassroots group that was behind it. And the more and more protests, it seems like people started coming to town and kind of whispers of this could have been a racist act started happening. And I don't really believe that that was the family's belief, at least not when I spoke to them right after the shooting. And I don't know if that's their belief now. I haven't talked to them in several months. But it definitely, when I first spoke to them, their main concern was the mental health of Dontre and that his needs weren't really being met.
How would you compare the official responses from the police and city to Dontre Hamilton's shooting in Milwaukee and Tony Robinson's in Madison?
Well, it's definitely different. I mean, I thought it was interesting that in Madison, the chief immediately reached out to the family and also immediately named the officer who was involved in the shooting. That didn't happen here in Milwaukee. Police Chief Flynn met with the Hamilton family, but it was not for several weeks after the shooting. It also was in the presence of the Hamilton family attorneys, and it wasn't like what was described in Madison, where the chief sat with, you know, Mr. Robinson's grandparents and prayed. So it was just very different. And then also, the Officer Manny name was not mentioned for several months, and that happened during a fire and police commission meeting, and it was Dontre's brother who said it. It was never released by the police. So it was very different. And I don't know if things went smoother, for lack of a better word, in Madison because of what happened in Milwaukee and if lessons were learned, or if Milwaukee's just a larger city with, you know, they've got a I'm not sure.
Now, after many of these shootings around the country, there have been calls for changes in the way policing is done or police officers have trained. Has there been any move toward that or talk of that in Milwaukee in this last 11 months?
There have. There have been some positive changes here in Milwaukee. Police Chief Flynn and Mayor Tom Barrett have made a commitment that the police department is going to undergo training so that they will better be able to handle people when they have mental illness. So before before the shooting, only about 25% of the police officers had that training. And now they said that, you know, beginning in 2015, which now we're into, they're all going to be trained. I'm not sure how long that will take. I know it's a very comprehensive training program, so it takes several weeks. But all new officers are going to have it, and all existing officers will eventually have it.
Briefly, as you wrap up, Corey, how has this whole story over the last year affected the Milwaukee community?
You know, I don't know if it's affected the Milwaukee community as a whole as much as sometimes it looks like it on the news. Again, I think it's affected a pocket of the Milwaukee community, but I don't think everybody is even aware of what happened. Like I said, it didn't gain the national attention, and luckily all of the protests have been peaceful. Both the Hamilton family has made sure that they've remained peaceful, and the police department has made them peaceful. I mean, so I don't think, in a good way, it's really had a terrible impact on the community. I mean, it's a terrible tragedy that happened, but I think the community is okay.
Corey,
that makes sense.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We would speak with Corinne Hess. She's a Milwaukee area freelance journalist. She wrote the piece, A City's Tragedy, about the shooting of Dontre Hamilton in this month's issue of Milwaukee Magazine. The giant coffee chain Starbucks is preparing to kick off a campaign known as Race Together. In partnership with USA Today, a series of inserts will be distributed tomorrow that aim to spark conversations about race in the U.S. And at Starbucks coffee houses, baristas will write the words Race Together on coffee cups. To-go ones, I guess, and hopefully launch conversations about race with their customers.
In the days leading up to the campaign launch, Starbucks is already hearing backlash from consumers who say this is an inappropriate move for a corporation to make.
Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz said he rejects that idea. He says these conversations are vitally important and need to be had in the wake of high-profile shootings of young African-American men by white police officers.
Cindy Kernahan is with us now. She's a professor of psychology at UW-River Falls. She teaches about the psychology of prejudice and racism. Cindy, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks.
Well, so first of all, what do you think about this idea? We're going to focus on Starbucks because this is the angle here that's getting the most response. Starbucks writing Race Together on a coffee cup and then encouraging baristas and customers to have an impromptu conversation in the coffee house, I guess, about race.
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of, I guess, issues or problems with it, right? So I understand why it sounds, I think superficially it sounds like a good idea. Like, let's just talk about race and that will help to solve it, because a lot of times talking about problems helps to solve them. But the problem here, I think, is sort of twofold. One is that, you know, if you have a good understanding about race and racism in America, you know that it's not really just about people's personal feelings or perspectives. There's this big, large, you know, set of institutional structures and policies and systems and all that, and most importantly, history. And so all of that is hard to have in a short conversation. You know, I mean, that's one thing. And then the other thing that I think is difficult, right, is that you really need some expertise to talk about this. I have to say, as someone who's been teaching about it for a long time, over 15 years now, it's really hard to do this well. I mean, it's hard to do it in a way that isn't just, you know, sort of beating the other person over the head with your opinion and really being open. That just takes a lot of work. And so I've read about it, and there's no real training for the baristas or anything like that. And I can tell you it takes a lot of training, I think, to do it well. So those are kind of the main, I guess, concerns I would have.
And the commentary is already exploding about the ways that could go wrong. There's a tweet here from Gwen Eiffel, PBS NewsHour host,
yeah,
on Twitter. She wrote, honest yep. to God, if you start to engage me in a race conversation before I've had my morning coffee, it will not end well. That
right,
from Gwen
yeah.
Eiffel. So if Gwen Eiffel can't
have a
decent conversation, I mean, what is the hope for the average person?
Right. And I think, again, what that speaks to is that it's more than just an individual perspective. There's this big, long history, which is part of what makes it so hard. And, I mean, you can see this in lots of places where we try to have conversations, right? Think about Hurricane Katrina, or if you really want to go back, think about O.J. Simpson. And, you know, white and black folks had really different responses to that. And part of the reason for that is because, you know, there are different day-to-day experiences. And also, I think there's a lot of research that shows that, you know, when black Americans look at events like that, they're bringing, they're, it's not just about Ferguson, let's say, it's about the larger context of police sort of brutality and discrimination that they're more likely to experience, whereas white people don't really have that. And since we don't have that experience, I should say, and maybe don't have that more contextual understanding, so there, you know, that's part of why it's so difficult to talk about, because people are coming from these very different sets of experiences and understandings.
So when you take out the ways in which it could go wrong, the mm-hmm. lack of a common frame for people yeah. who are talking, is there still something sort of bravely naive or naively brave maybe about this move?
I think it's a good
Starbucks.
Way of putting it. Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it. I understand. I think I understand why. I mean, I've read some of what Howard Schultz, the CEO of Starbucks, had to say about it. And I think it's like, hey, you know, we're not talking about this. This is obviously a problem. People obviously have these really different perspectives. So I can see why it seems like it should work. I just think without the training and that's the part that's naive, right? It's like we can do this without having any sort of facilitators or having sort of a deeper set of information to come from.
Do you think just having this originate from a corporation like Starbucks mm. is part of the problem, that this is just sort of inherently the wrong venue and having it, it's not monetized, but it's happening because of a monetary exchange.
Yeah.
Is there a better way for a different entity to do this, or is Starbucks, they just shouldn't have tried it at all?
Well, I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm naive, but I sort of take them at their word that they actually, like, they really want to do something about this. But I do think that that does make people inherently skeptical of it. I mean, when you read some of the commentary and some of the backlash online, what you see is that there are plenty of people who say, this is just about making the Starbucks logo look good. This is just about making them look progressive. And this is just part of their sort of corporate MO, you know, to take on controversial or sort of touchy topics or whatever. So, I mean, I don't know that that's true, but I do think you're right that probably serves to make people skeptical rather than sort of welcoming or open. And this is a space that people are, I can tell you teaching it, people are sort of automatically coming in with their defenses up when they talk about this. Even students who sign up for a class, Global Psychology, Prejudice and Racism, they come in, you know, a little nervous, which makes sense because we don't, especially white Americans, don't talk about race a lot. So I think, yeah, that's just going to make it all the much harder.
If Starbucks does want to contribute to positive conversations about race, mm-hmm. foster understanding, empathy, all of that, mm-hmm. as a corporation, what should they do? What would, if you were planning it, what would have been a better move for them to make?
Oh, gosh. Well, that's such a fun question. So I can think of a couple of things. One, right, is that I think it would be, to me, having taught this for a long time, one of the things that I think is the most important element that's missing in terms of people not coming from a common frame, as you put it, is historical understanding. So I think, like, if I were planning it, I don't know what those inserts in USA Today are going to be tomorrow, but I would want them to be all about sort of connecting the past to the present. And there's some really good writers on race that are out there today, right? So like Ta-Nehisi Coates is someone that I think of right off the bat. He's a writer for The Atlantic, and he wrote a long piece last year that got a lot of attention and awards, The Case for Reparations. That particular piece has a lot of historical information in it. So, you know, I'd have to think about how to design them, but definitely I think those inserts should not just be different people's perspectives necessarily, but sort of a deeper historical understanding. The other thing that might be fun, and this just occurs to me in the fantasy of this question, right, is that what would be so fun if they could use their store, the spaces, not for baristas to have to do this work, because I think that's kind of unfair for them, given that they don't really have any training. But what if they hired a bunch of people who know how to teach about race or know how to facilitate those conversations? There are a lot of people like that, not just college professors, but lots of people. Then this is a whole scholarly area. It's a lot of work to do this. And so a lot of people have written articles and books about how to do this. Hire those people to facilitate some in store conversations. That might be really fun. Not as quick, not as easy, but it could be much more effective, I think.
Interesting ideas there. We'll have to see if Starbucks pays attention to you. So barring your suggestions there, Starbucks goes its own way. But what is a good way to have a collective conversation? Because this is something that's not just happening in one state, one city. It's happening nationwide right now. How do we effectively have a collective conversation about race or anything, I guess?
Yeah, well, I think it comes back to that sort of common frame. I mean, the way that I like to teach about it is that I want everybody to read the same thing before class. And so, you know, maybe that might be the best way to have these kinds of conversations is to have them where, you know, people either see the same video or read the same something, some piece of content or something that they can have that's thought provoking. And there's no shortage of that kind of material out there. That helps a lot. I think the other thing too, is that these kinds of conversations really need to be structured if possible, which I know is not as easy, but it does help a lot. And a lot of research shows, like, people are really nervous going into conversations like this, understandably. And so I think that's why structure helps a lot. You know, having someone to guide the discussion, having a common set of information to work from. Again, it makes it harder, and it's not as quick or simple, but I think it's definitely more effective. That's what I've seen in teaching.
We're talking right now with Cindy Kernahan, professor of psychology at UW River Falls, about a new campaign by Starbucks and USA Today that hopes to spark a national conversation about race.
And we want to hear from you. What do you think about this effort, the idea of a big coffee shop chain trying to provoke friendly conversations about race in the United States? Is this the right way to go about this, or do you think there's a better way to address the issue of race in America? Is this an issue you feel comfortable talking about with people you know well, much less the person pouring your latte? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@WPR.org.
We're talking now with Cindy Kernahan of UW River Falls about how to effectively have a meaningful dialogue about race in America. Starbucks launches a campaign tomorrow called Race Together that's trying to do just that.
And we want to hear from you. Is this something you think is long overdue? Have you tried to have conversations about race with your network of friends, family, acquaintances, coworkers? How did it go? Is a coffee shop the place to try to provoke these conversations? Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@WPR.org.
And we're going to go to our first caller. Nathan joins us now in Brookfield. Hi, Nathan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had two comments here. The first was, I think open conversation is a good thing. You don't need to be an expert in something to have a discussion and learn from people. The second point that I'd like to make is the comment that white people can't experience racism or understand that. There's racism going on in every single direction, regardless of who you are.
All right, Nathan, appreciate your call and your thoughts there. And Cindy, what do you think about that? If we want to have an open conversation, if someone is amenable to getting that coffee cup with Race Together and wants to chat, I mean, is there anything wrong with just going ahead and taking a swing at it?
No, not necessarily. And I don't think necessarily you have to be an expert to talk about it. I just think it helps to have an expert there to facilitate it, because it is a difficult thing to do. I mean, one thing that I think illustrates that, right, is the idea that of who experiences racism. When I was talking before, I didn't mean that white people don't experience prejudicial treatment or they don't experience racist treatment. That's not what I meant. What I mean is that when you look at people's experiences, they are different. There's lots of research that shows that I think there's a poll last year, for example, that showed that Black Americans, almost 50% of them said that at some point in their lives they had experienced discrimination at the hands of police, whereas the same number for white Americans was, I think, less than 1% or something. And so that difference in day-to-day experience is important. It can be hard to bridge that in conversation. And so I think sometimes that can be heard as, you know, I think it takes work and effort to sort of be able to imagine the other person's experience if you've never had that. And so that comment of, you know, who experiences racism, I think is easy to misunderstand if if you don't have sort of a structure and someone there to help with that conversation. So I don't mean that you can't talk about it. I just think it's helpful and it's more likely to be useful if you have some expertise around.
Well, Nathan, thanks for the call. And we're going to go next to Ellen in Middleton. Ellen, hi.
Hi. My son is a barista at Starbucks out at the mothership in Seattle, and I spoke with him about this, and he thought it was the most ridiculous thing he'd heard of. For one thing, there's a very practical issue of baristas needing to serve coffee. They are not there to have discussions about race. Most Starbucks are very busy, and this just seems ridiculous. Second thing is, what does race together mean? I mean, what does that mean? If they want to write something on a cup, why don't they go back into some great quotes and use the ability to print up a bunch of cups with some thoughtful quotes that people can sit at a coffee table and discuss maybe while they're drinking their coffee? But to give this task to baristas, untrained baristas, that's also maybe right under baristas are busy. Baristas are not trained to talk about race.
Got it. Thank you, Ellen. I just want to get our guest in this because we're getting a little short on time. And Cindy, it's interesting to hear a perspective from a barista because that hasn't been a point of view that's been out there. I don't know if they're allowed to publicly voice their opinions right now or not, but that's one. And the time pressure there. What do you think about what Ellen had to say?
Yeah, I wonder about that because we haven't heard from them. I mean, that's the one, I was thinking that earlier today, that's the one perspective that's really been missing in all this blowback and discussion about it. You don't see any of the people who work at Starbucks, or at least I haven't seen them commenting. And I think her comment was really interesting about putting thoughtful quotes and letting people discuss. That reminds me of was it Chipotle last year, I think, that had authors write poetry or write short stories on their bags or something. I don't know if I'm getting the chain mixed up, but that was something that I think is sort of an interesting idea because, again, that gives you a common framework to talk from, which I think makes it a little easier.
Well, thanks a bunch, Ellen. We're going to go next to Donald in Green Bay. Hi, Donald.
Hello there. I guess I'm going to be one of the few contrary voices here. I was a college professor myself at the University of Minnesota, where I taught anthropology and American Indian Studies. And my opinion is anything that starts a dialogue is a good thing. I mean, if we had to wait for the experts to settle in and deliver some wise, sage advice, we'd still have slavery. I'm American Indian. My people would still be being shot somewhere riding a horse around. You have to do things that engage everyone, and wherever you begin is a beneficial beginning.
All right. Thank you so much, Donald. Appreciate that point of view. And Ellen, we've only got a little bit of time left here, but what about just opening the door? I'm sorry, not Cindy. What about just opening the door for conversation anywhere that you find that door? I mean, you don't find Starbucks in all neighborhoods, certainly, but where you right. do, is that okay, what Donald's saying?
Yeah, I think so. Again, my point about expertise is just that I think it's more likely to make it useful and meaningful and actually get somewhere. And so that's all I mean when I talk about having experts. Certainly, it's good to talk about stuff, but I think what experts do is experts in teaching, can help you sort of structure that conversation in a way that allows everybody to feel heard, to be heard, and to get somewhere at the end of it.
And Cindy, we're just about out of time, but if you go into a Starbucks and you see that race together on your cup, are you going to have that talk?
I think I would feel bad asking the, again, just that issue of like, do they have time? Do they want to talk about it? I think I'd feel a little bit nervous. So I even though I've been teaching this for a long time, I'd probably wait to see what they did first because I wouldn't want to be intrusive.
All right. Well, Cindy, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That was Cindy Kernahan, professor of psychology at UW River Falls. She teaches about the psychology of racism and prejudice.
Now we'll check in with our own Terry Bell, who is covering Wisconsin musicians going to this year's South by Southwest Music Festival.
The South by Southwest Festival in Austin, Texas, is drawing a wide variety of musical talent from Wisconsin again this year. From public radio favorites Count This Penny to Milwaukee rapper Wave Chappelle. Also this year, Milwaukee's Group of the Altos, which has been described as post-rock or avant-garde with influences of horror, heavy metal, and 1970s AM radio rock.
Are you listening? Am I- I recently sat down with Alto's frontman Daniel Spack and singer Mario Allschwang to talk about how Alto's went from two members to 16.
Yeah, it was me and Tom Duffy got together and we were just screwing around, basically. And we would write one long composition, and then as soon as we felt like we had it pretty good, we would stop playing it and then try another one. And then Sean Stefani showed up and thought it was totally interesting. So then we had a member, and it was like, well, maybe we're a band.
You know, and now you're 16 members. How did that original small minimalist concept get so big?
Yeah, I mean, we very pushily grabbed certain members. Like Marielle, actually, we saw her perform one night, and I was not accepting no for an answer.
I was playing a solo show, and one of our other members was in a sort of string quartet-y kind of number.
Yeah.
So we were sharing a bill, so she brought a lot of members of Alto's there. And, yeah, Daniel came and talked to me, and I was charmed.
Aww.
You've collaborated with Justin Vernon in Volcano Choir. Most people would know Justin from his work in Bon Iver. What kind of influence has he had on you?
Oh, yeah, it's massive. I mean, it just learned zillions about how to work with, you know, especially vocalists. I had never really worked with a vocalist in my life, so, you know, it shaped a lot of how I figured out phrasing and everything. And just the idea that vocals could be this other instrument that you used.
Because, yeah, you saw yourself as an instrumentalist first and foremost. You were pretty reluctant to sing.
Yeah, horribly reluctant. It was never a thing in my head or heart that said that I should even attempt it.
Your music is described as post-rock, which is a title that you say doesn't mean a whole lot to you. But you seem okay with your songs being described as having a dark side.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that first record is a little bit dark, and it has a lot to do with, I mean, everybody's lives at that time, you know.
Well, I've read that horror is a big influence on your music.
Yeah.
What is
yeah.
that about?
That's a great question, and if you asked everyone in the group, you would get a different answer.
And now you're playing South by Southwest. Do you see this as an opportunity?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, I seek out every opportunity, you know. And, like, we just came out with a record that I think is really great, and hopefully that means something, you know. So if we don't do everything that we can to get it somewhere, then, you know, shame on us.
A typical plain spoken Midwestern straightforward thoughts from Daniel Spack. Milwaukee's Group of the Altos is one of many acts in Wisconsin playing the South by Southwest Festival in Austin, Texas.
That was Wisconsin Public Radio's Terry Bell.
All right, we keep failing to do this every year. We need to start the WPR band and get some shows at South by Southwest. Next year, Veronica, are we on?
Sounds easy. Yeah, definitely.
We've got some drummers. At least two
We've
of
got
them.
Got drummers, right, saxophonists.
Mm-hmm. Guitarists.
Others. Yeah. Singers.
Yeah, I don't think this is going to go well.
Yeah.
Maybe 2 years. Make
it's
it a
worth
two-year
a shot,
plan.
Right?
Well, coming up, President Obama says he wants the federal government to set an example when it comes to reducing carbon emissions. He has set the goal of cutting 40% in 10 years from parts of the federal government, the vehicle fleet, buildings, all of it. That's coming up in just a few. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.